Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Today we're joined by Tim Yerka, head of Feed AI at LinkedIn. As you can imagine, Feed AI is responsible for curating all the content you see daily on the LinkedIn site. What's less apparent, though, to those that don't work on this type of product is the wide variety of opposing factors that need to be considered in organizing and optimizing the feed. As you'll learn in our conversation, this challenge is what Tim calls the holistic optimization of the feed, and we discuss some of the really interesting technical and business issues associated with trying to do this. In particular, we talk through some of the specific techniques used at LinkedIn, like multi-arm bandits and content embeddings, and we also jump into a really interesting discussion about how to organize for machine learning at scale. Before we get going, I'd like to send a huge thanks to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's show. LinkedIn Engineering solves complex challenges at scale to create economic opportunity for every member of the global workforce. AI and ML are integral aspects of almost every product the company builds for its members and customers. LinkedIn's highly structured dataset gives their data scientists and researchers the ability to conduct applied research to improve member experiences. To learn more about the work of LinkedIn Engineering, visit engineering.linkedin.com/blog. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am here with Tim Yerka, head of Feed AI at LinkedIn. Tim, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thanks for having me. I've listened to a lot of your episodes, so it's great to be here on the show.
Fantastic. I am really looking forward to diving into some of the ways that you use AI to optimize the LinkedIn feed. But before we do that, how did you get started working in AI?
Via a pretty circuitous route, I think.
That's less surprising than you may think.
Maybe. So my undergraduate, actually, I started in political science, and I could really not decide between political science and computer science.
Okay.
And I was very fortunate to stumble upon a research assistantship kind of halfway through undergrad with a professor at Davis, Amber Boydston, who was doing a lot of computational social science. And to their credit, political scientists have basically been aggregating news for the last several decades and annotating it manually with research assistants. So they had these massive code books, massive quantities of data that were all manually annotated. You know, like this is about the war in Iraq. This is about like the economy, on and on and on. And it seems like a perfect solution for machine learning, right? This is like you have the data there. And so we started working together. We wrote some tools in R to start doing text classification and basically classifying millions of news articles over the course of the last 60 years into all these categories, with the goal being, can we start looking at how the American electorate's issue priorities have changed over time? So this is kind of like a dynamic trend over time. You know, what do people care about and how does the media influence what they care about in American politics? So it was a really interesting intersection of, I think, computational social science or political science and computer science that really turned me on to machine learning and AI. And I actually continued, I started doing my PhD in political science also with Amber at UC Davis. And that kind of continued for a few years until some personal family circumstances caused me to leave the program. And I had to find a job to pay the bills. And I stumbled across a startup called Pulse, which was an RSS aggregator. And it was really just a perfect fit when Akshay, the CEO of Pulse, talked to me and asked me to join as their first machine learning engineer. He was like, "We're an RSS aggregator. We're aggregating millions of articles like every single day, and we want you to basically classify these into categories and start personalizing people's news reading experience." And so it was like the perfect fit of what I had been doing already in graduate school within the industry. So while at Pulse, we built up the first recommendation system, and I did not spend much time there. Within 4 months, we had been acquired by LinkedIn, and that's how I entered LinkedIn. So that's a quite circuitous route to actually make my way into LinkedIn and into AI. Once here, we started redesigning the Pulse app, and the really cool thing I think about LinkedIn data was the fact that we could use the news content that we were ingesting and the economic graph data, and we could start generating insights. And so these insights, you actually see them today in the LinkedIn feed because they eventually made their way out of the Pulse app into the main LinkedIn feed. But you can say, hey, here's stuff that's trending in your industry. These are news insights you will not get on other social networks because we have that kind of standardized data about where are people working, what are their skills. So we introduced a bunch of these kind of what we call intelligent insights into the feed, trending in your industry, trending at your company, like what are people reading in aggregate and what might you be missing? So that's how I started working on the LinkedIn feed.
Yeah, I think that most folks are probably familiar with the feed at the from a user perspective. One of the things that you and I were chatting about before we got started was this kind of broader challenge of what you called holistic optimization of the feed.
Right.
Which seems like an interesting place to kind of jump in talking about some of the challenges that you're working with. When you say holistic optimization of the feed, what does that mean?
Yeah. So I use the term holistic because whenever I go to a conference or like I'm presenting our work, a lot of the people that are in this space, like building recommender systems, they're still thinking about the like nation stages of their problem. And so they're saying like, hey, let's like sort by CTR or some like simple metric, right? Like let's just show the most likely stuff that somebody's gonna click on at the top of whatever they're building at the feed, like an ad, whatever it might be. I think the feed definitely started there, but we started identifying a lot of different actors. There's so many different reasons that people come to the feed, right? You may be coming to look for a job. You may be coming to learn a LinkedIn learning skill. You may be coming to read content or build an audience. And all these actors in the feed have a different intent. And when we talk about holistic optimization, it's really understanding those individual intents and making them work together. So in addition to, for example, sorting the feed for engagement and showing the most engaging content at the top, we may also want to say, you know, what incentivizes a creator on LinkedIn? Why are they visiting? And they're likely visiting to connect to an active community, to connect to an audience and build their brand. And if they post, like if you came to LinkedIn right now and you shared a link and explained the latest TWIML podcast episode topic and nobody engaged with that, that would not feel great. And it probably wouldn't be a really good incentive for you to come back to LinkedIn. And so we want to incentivize. We don't necessarily want to just incentivize the hyper-viral actors on LinkedIn that get, you know, a lot. They have a lot of influence already. We also want to incentivize new creators on the platform and encourage them to come back again and again. When I say holistic optimization, these things are sometimes in contradiction with each other. Optimizing for engagement and optimizing for like creator side value sometimes work in contrast to each other because sometimes you will sacrifice some engagement to give a creator a bit more attention with the intent that longer term, they will want to come back and connect with that audience that they've discovered on LinkedIn. And so these kinds of problems, there's several of them within the LinkedIn feed. The creator kind of consumer side is mm-hmm. one form of holistic optimization. I think the other one is what happens after you have engaged with your feed or created a conversation in the feed. So somebody created something, you may have left a comment. How did that impact your downstream network? Were you able to impact your second and third degree network to participate in that conversation? That is also like part of this holistic optimization equation. And then there's some more traditional kind of trade-offs when you consider holistic optimization when it comes to things like revenue and engagement. So this is a pretty well-known problem is, you know, ads are not as engaging as organic content. And if you completely optimize for revenue in the short term, you might actually be sacrificing like folks who want to come back long-term if they just saw more organic, engaging content. And that has much more value over the lifetime of a member using LinkedIn. And so you really can't be short-sighted when doing kind of a holistic optimization. You can't just focus on like short-term revenue or short-term engagement. You really need to create these retention funnels that people have built an active community. They want to come back and get insights from that community on LinkedIn and not just exploit kind of a short-term optimization.
When I hear what you're saying, I think of, you know, some optimization function with a bunch of different components, right? Yeah, but then I think of a whole, you know, different set of challenges around, you know, really understanding what those components should be and thinking mm-hmm. about like how to weight them, you know, more things that are closer to like the business side and the, you know, the vision of what you're trying to create for the service. How do you apportion or think about the relative, you know, challenge of those different aspects?
it's exactly the kinds of problems that we've had to tackle over the last 3 years. And I think there's two solutions, right? There's like a technical solution. And there is also kind of a product or business-based solution, as you mentioned, which is if you have strong opinions about how your business should operate, you can actually give the individual components of optimizing these different parts of the ecosystem and allow somebody who has, you know, really good product intuition, understands the business really well, to weight them. That's like the simplest non-technical way to handle this. But when you actually get into the technical solutions, there are a lot of interesting techniques that can be used to balance between these different objectives. We've started with things like multi-arm bandits to start tuning between these different objectives and finding kind of a sweet spot by exploring a bunch of different arms and seeing like, you know, which one is most promising. And we still have to have some human intervention in terms of which arm we finally choose, but it helps us understand the trade-off space. And that starts getting a bit more into the technical space. I think if you go even farther, and it's somewhere LinkedIn has not gotten yet, but you can start using neural nets to understand all the different players in the ecosystem and understand how to balance between those different incentives. And that's something that we're starting to look at in terms of reinforcement learning right now to solve this kind of problem of how do you balance between all these different objectives.
On the multi-arm bandit side, when you're applying that kind of approach, how are you kind of structuring that problem?
So it's really like, we take the traditional example of like revenue engagement trade-off, which we talked about earlier. I think there's a strong opinion that engagement is the best way to long-term bring a member back to LinkedIn, right? And so in our case, in FeedAI's case, we're really focused on, can we continue to grow the organic and kind of engagement ecosystem while keeping revenue healthy? And so you set some constraints to your multi-arm bandit to explore a space by which it's either keeping revenue flat or slightly positive while trying to maximize engagement, both short-term and long-term engagement. And so it's actually kind of a constrained problem. So you're not fully letting it go off and make a decision for you. But we're specifically applying these techniques in an individual kind of trade-off problem within the ecosystem. So we're not yet trading off between like three or four objectives with one system, right? We're making trade-offs between these pairwise objectives.
So then how do you then map that to the three or four different, is it a hierarchical type of approach where you're using the multi-arm bandit to kind of define the trade-off between engagement and revenue, and then, you know, for a particular kind of value of engagement, you then have other systems or, you know, kind of hierarchically apply multi-arm bandit or, you know, some multiple components to an objective function, like determine how you trade off the underlying things that contribute to engagement, or
so we
am I thinking about the problem space in the right way.
Yeah, you're thinking about it exactly in the right way, and it comes down to, you know, we have to set constraints that are informed by this kind of business and product opinion to the problem that's being solved by the multi-arm bandit solution, right? So we may say let's keep revenue like flat and let's like focus a bit more on engagement, and then there's the creator side of the equation, and we'll say, we actually want to, up to some limit, we want to incentivize creators. So we give the system a kind of budget to explore solutions by which it can incentivize creators and still move engagement forward. And similarly, when we look at downstream, there's like the same kind of constraint is put in place, which is like, can you move downstream engagement without affecting a viewer's engagement within a given session? So can you still keep them engaged with their feed, but like lengthen their impact down the chain of like second and third degree connections? So it's not a purely kind of unsupervised problem here. We are definitely introducing some product thinking and opinions as to like what the constraints should be, and letting the system explore solutions there, which is, that's the exploration part is really what I think humans are not good at, like reasoning about the various trade-offs once you've put some constraints in place. And so that's where I think these kind of techniques are super helpful in finding that balance to how do we holistically optimize across all these different objectives with some opinions on what the constraints should be in that ecosystem.
And so there's a big part of making this actually usable relate to the kind of interface between the systems and the folks that are responsible for kind of managing this trade-off and the objectives, and kind of what does that look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a very kind of tight coupling between the AI team, the infrastructure teams, the product teams that build all this, our entire feed product team is very familiar with AI techniques and how they think about the role AI plays in the products and how to trade off between different objectives. I think we don't have to change the balance very frequently, right? We set forth a strategy in terms of what we want the ecosystem to look like, and we really design our system around like, can you optimize given the strategy and given the constraints that you know our product partners have laid out. And that does not change very frequently. Of course, the system has to constantly adapt because the models change. And so it has to constantly recalibrate kind of how much weight you're giving to each model. But the actual underlying strategy will mainly remain in place, you know, over time. So you don't have to adapt that.
Is the approach that we're talking about where you're using multi-arm bandit to balance between a couple of metrics and then within that space, kind of optimize. Even as I'm talking about it, it's still fuzzy. Like, how do we get to the next level of detail here and make it a little bit more concrete?
Yeah. So I think it's good to think about it in terms of we have a lot of different objective functions with trade-off parameters in the broader optimization, right? So the broader optimization function can be, for example, we have your viewer side engagement, we have the creator side value, and we have some trade-off between those two. We have the revenue engagement or the revenue component. We have a trade-off for that component and downstream impact. All of these have different tunable parameters in terms of how much weight we give each of these objectives. And so what's really difficult is finding the right balance across, say, those four objectives. While meeting the constraints that we've laid out in terms of, you know, we don't want to drop revenue. We want to continue to provide creator value within some realm. And so what the multi-arm bandit really helps is it can explore all the different kind of trade-off variations for these four different objectives and then propose a few that actually will meet the constraints and the criteria that we've laid out in accordance with the strategy. So really what it comes down to is can we explore space and identify a set of, let's say, four trade-off parameters that meet all the constraints that we've identified? Mm-hmm. And so that requires essentially setting up a system that for different parts of the population on LinkedIn is trying different variations of the parameter and seeing what the outcome is. Like, how is this impacting the revenue metric? How is this impacting the engagement metric or downstream metric? And then getting a readout and a gradient across like a bunch of different parameters.
You may have just answered my next question, which is this, are you applying the multi-arm bandit as a way to explore on kind of live interactions, or are you doing it in simulation and using that to determine model parameters that you deploy out to prod?
There's two ways we do this, right? So for individual objectives, some of them are actually quite predictable offline, right? We can predict whether our models are doing a better job of, say, starting a conversation mm-hmm. purely via offline simulation. Because when we train our models, we basically will compare it to like a randomized list of updates that a member has seen via like unbiased data collection. And we'll basically see, does this new model actually lift items that they've clicked on like higher up? And so via offline simulation, we can basically tell, replaying on old data, hey, you know, like this model is actually more likely to start conversations. When it comes to things like revenue, it's much more difficult to simulate offline because you have so many moving parts around like seasonality, around like supply and demand of the ads ecosystem. And so those are really things that you have to adapt live online once you've kind of shipped the model to production. And so it's a dual answer, right? Offline for the objectives where we can actually replay on historical data where there isn't a lot of these confounding factors, we will ship those models online. And then for those that we can't, we will tune via the multi-arm bandit system between the different objectives. Because our primary goal is like, can we get people to form active communities and start conversations? That is the primary objective that we can simulate offline. And it's like what we base a lot of our like ship decisions on. Like, have we enabled people to start more conversations? Does this model do a better job at that? If so, bring it online. And then let's find how to tune for the other constraints that we've imposed on the ecosystem, rather than trying to solve all the problems all at once offline. Mm-hmm. So engagement is really conversations, like starting conversations, incentivizing creators, that's really the seed of where we start kind of the optimization.
And you mentioned reinforcement learning as a potential future direction in this area.
Yeah.
How would you see it applied here?
So I think it's still super early days. So I don't know how much detail I would go in here, but if you can define kind of the action space and the different actors in the ecosystem, you could potentially set up a problem that can be more holistically optimized in terms of rather than manually training each objective individually, you can actually optimize for all the objectives simultaneously. So again, it's super early days. I probably would not go into a lot of detail here, but.
You are kind of optimizing this kind of holistic optimization of the elements that you're showing in the feed. You know, to what degree are we also applying AI to understand the individual elements that pop up in the feed? And, you know, what are some of the pieces that come into that? Like, I'm envisioning, like, you know, applying models to images to understand which images are more engaging, applying NLP to, you know, headings and to try to understand which of those are more engaging. Are you, do you think about it at all like that, like macro and micro type of?
Yeah. I mean, it's to kind of like, we've spent most of our time thus far, like talking about like how we frame the optimization of like the overarching feed ecosystem, which is like a really tricky problem because of all these actors.
Right.
Then you have all the kind of like understanding that goes into the different features of the content. These are actually like features that are then put into that model to like help us do a better job actually predicting whatever target we're trying to predict. And so there's a lot of things we do on this front. For like text and image-based content, we have, we generate content embeddings to understand, let's say like a text update and like how text updates relate to themselves, relate to each other. And mapping that to like members' interests, like what have you read in the past? What is on your profile? Where have you worked? Like how does this content relate to your interests? So we definitely use like neural net based techniques to generate embeddings there.
Mm-hmm. Can we drill into that for a second?
Yeah, sure.
So we've talked quite a bit on the podcast in general about embeddings and the idea that you can kind of map the set of, you know, content into some embedding space and then use that to determine, you know, where a new piece of content, what it's like, and kind of relate it to the attributes of other content that you've already seen. Mm-hmm. But then when you mentioned relating that to the user, like how do you create the connection between this content embedding space and different users and user contexts?
Yeah, so let's talk mostly about just like the text-based problem, because I think that's a good example to start, like any text-based update. So there's a lot of articles and posts that go into the LinkedIn feed that have text. Every member profile is also heavily text-based. We have like past work history. We have a job summary. We have a list of skills that a member has.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually essentially create a joint embedding space for both members and articles, where you are understanding a particular token, and it's been trained on top of both of these data sets, right? Like member profiles and articles.
So you're abstracting away from what the individual token represents, whether it's a piece of content or a user or, you know, some entity in the economic graph, to more, you know, it's something that has a relationship with text in this broader context.
Right, in this data set. And so that's like at the token level, right?
Okay.
The document then becomes the document that shows up in the feed, whether it be the article or whatever, or the member profile.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up essentially creating like vector representations of, say, like a member profile or vector representations of whatever update type in the feed. And you can actually look at the similarity of these and say, like, you know, how much does this member care about this particular update? Is it relevant to their work history at all? And like, will it actually advance their professional career via providing this information? Or is it very tangential to their interests?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of that's like the deep learned, like wide and deep nets used to, like, you know, understand content. And we also go a much more like human in the loop route. So we have a content understanding team in Dublin, and that team is composed of linguists and engineers. And the linguists actually created what we call like the interest graph, which is an ontology of interests, professional interests. And there you actually have hierarchical relationships that are curated by linguists and taxonomists in terms of like, how do these concepts relate to each other? And this is particularly helpful when you have applications where you actually want to expose to the user, like why you're seeing this. You know, like you're seeing this because you are interested in this particular topic. And when you want to display that, it's much more difficult to like reverse engineer an embedding and explain like, you know, mm-hmm. this is why you're saying this. But with that ontology, it not only lets you kind of explain to the user why we're showing them, but it also, because of the hierarchical nature, it introduces a lot of interesting applications, right? Like you can back off to like more generality if you're getting like too specific, like if you're tagging it with, reinforcement learning, but you actually want to back off to just, let's say, like machine learning or artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. You can do that up the ontology. And also, when you go into problems like candidate selection and like what kinds of content you want to show members, if you do not have enough liquidity under a very granular node in this interest graph, you can back off and go to broader topics that are still related, but may have more inventory, meaning people are writing more about that topic on LinkedIn. And so both those techniques in tandem are actually super helpful in understanding the content and then explaining to members, you know, why are we showing this to you in your feed?
And so when you say both of them in tandem, are there use cases where you use the ontology and use cases where you use the embeddings, or are there ways that you confuse them for specific, you know, category of problems where that makes sense?
So we started with actually treating these individually as like separate features, right? So, and they both showed that they provide unique value in terms of predicting whether members will participate in conversations. But as our kind of thinking evolved, these interest-based features can actually directly be incorporated into the embedding. And you can introduce even more like nonlinearity that maybe like the humans have created a very strict structure to this ontology, and actually putting it directly in the embedding can actually uncover even more relationships between these different interest nodes that we were not able to uncover just, you know, through curation. So it's an evolution, right? You start mm-hmm. with kind of proving the value of both independently as like individual feature sets within your broader model. And then you find ways to actually like have one help the other, for example, mm-hmm. like putting the interest graph-based features into the embedding. And then they actually start complementing each other and start fusing into one broader content understanding feature.
So I guess what I'm hearing you say is, you know, we're just talking about text. You take a piece of text and you map that to the interest graph, and then you stick that in the embedding, as opposed to, I guess what I was thinking through was, it's natural for me to take a text piece of content and map it to like a topic that it's related to. It's less natural for me to map a person to a topic. But if the person is just a kind of a bag of text, then yep. you can do that.
You could do that. You can also look at like, what has the member engaged with in the past, right? Mm-hmm. And you have the labeled data from the interest graph. And so you actually create this like a vector representation, but not learned via like a neural net, mm-hmm. Of like what interests in the interest graph does the member care about? Mm-hmm. And that's super helpful because it's actually much more understandable to the member. Like they understand like, okay, this is what you think my interests are. It's why you're recommending this piece of content to me. So it's less about taking like their profile and mapping it to the interest graph, and more about like looking at their historical behavior. What have they read on LinkedIn, and using the interest graph. So I think that's where like the more the ontology based technique, the manual curation differs slightly from the deep learned embeddings, where we can actually take the member's profile directly and project it into the embedding space.
So what are some of the other big challenges that you focus on from a feed perspective?
So yeah, we've kind of covered like, you know, optimization. I think there's like a lot of different feature engineering that goes into understanding the content that's in the ecosystem. And then I think the third probably big one is foundations in terms of how you empower your team to move fast and run experiments. I know you had Bi-Chung Chen on like a previous podcast, and you were talking mm-hmm. a bit about ProML. So feed, obviously, like, you know, it's a really large vertical at LinkedIn, and we want to experiment with a lot of different ideas. And so we're running, you know, hundreds of A-B tests every single quarter to figure out kind of how are we going to activate members' professional communities and spark professional conversations. To do that, you're kind of starting to go into the realm of using AI to make AI, like the AI team, more productive, right? So it's less about AI to optimize the business end of the equation and more AI to actually optimize engineering.
So what's a specific example of that?
So I think starting from automation, like just getting your models automatically deployed in production, automatically identifying which variants you want to deploy to production, even identifying, so something like feature engineering, which was like the bulk of work that I think we did in the industry, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Now a lot of that feature engineering can actually be just automatically, like that can be automatically explored via like an AI, right? And when I say AI, I mean like you can probably like generate an embedding from a bunch of features that are available to you in a feature index and see which of those actually like make sense in advancing your objective. That no longer requires kind of a human in the loop for a lot of those problems. And so if you can automate some of the stuff like how you deploy models, how you engineer like features or simpler features, you actually free up, you may like start automating 60% or 70% of what, say, an entry-level engineer on the team would do. And their time is freed up to think about these harder problems around optimization of the ecosystem and like how do they think about trade-offs and how do they automate those trade-off decisions that we were talking about earlier when we're thinking about holistic optimization. So automation is definitely one of the key aspects here. And then the other aspect is how do you make sure that you know, you're constantly monitoring your model performance once stuff is online, and that you are making sure your models don't rot, kind of in the way we think of code rot. So you have systems that are like automatically retraining models, like on sliding windows, like every day, on newer data, and saying like, okay, this period of data actually is like not as good because, you know, something was wrong with the tracking data that was passed back to us. And then it might identify a new period and say, hey, this is actually a much better training data period. Let's actually ramp this in production. And so the system can now automatically retrain the models on newer data and also exploit that and push out to production in an automated way. These are all things that like historically engineers would all do manually. And actually like the kind of competitive advantage to being a machine learning engineer was understanding this process end to end. And now like I think a lot of what AI empowers and machine learning empowers is these kind of discovery mechanisms of like, which feature should I use in the model? Which period of data should I retrain on? Like all that is abstracted away from the engineer and they focus on like the harder AI and machine learning challenges.
I'm imagining that Feed is a big customer of ProML. Can you speak at all to the relationship between kind of the customer of a platform and a platform? So we recently, you may have seen the interview with Bichung was in the context of a broader AI platforms series of podcasts that we did. And that was largely with kind of the, you know, the supply side, if you will, the folks that are providing those platforms. But as a customer of those platforms, you know, you are on the other side of, you know, a whole set of decisions that they're making around, you know, the degree to which the platform is opinionated versus not, the degree to which, a lot of the decisions kind of boil down to that, right? What's your take on it from the other side?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a very symbiotic relationship in the sense that, you know, we are giving a lot of requests to like what we want as a like capability to be enabled for ProML. I think if you think about ProML as like the foundation of LinkedIn AI, the first thing that ProML has to do is handle the average case, like the average path of how an engineer is getting something to production really well. And so for some verticals that are starting to face unique challenges at scale, there's this relationship where we might identify a problem before another team has even identified it. And we pass that knowledge back to ProML and say, hey, you know, we're now realizing that, you know, we're having trouble, let's say, there's too many models being shipped to production and we need some way to like actually stage these in terms of how they get out there. And we need to like rebase them automatically on top of each other. So like this is something that ProML may have not seen from other verticals just yet. And then we will identify that problem, give that request back to them. And they then build that out in terms of a platform capability that everybody can use. So it's really about, ProML is essentially enabling a lot of the new directions that we want to go through building the foundational infrastructure. If you want to build something like a GLM mix model and you want to start introducing like decision trees into that, maybe that's not supported today. And maybe nobody has had a use case yet for that. That's where the verticals, I think, really push the kind of horizontal ProML initiative into thinking about how they shape their roadmap. So, I mean, that's kind of it from a customer side.
To what extent is there a tension there, or is at least in the case of the way things are set up at LinkedIn, like do you end up having to make decisions when you're kind of pushing, you know, the edge and you're one of the bigger customers, whether you kind of wait for the platform to deliver something or you kind of build it yourself?
And all the time.
Do you end up with, you know, how do you manage, like I'm imagining kind of code debt kind of situations where, you know, you invest in some kind of, you know, the ability to do things that you need, you know, eventually the platform catches up. And do you have kind of formalized thinking around this or mature thinking around this, or do you kind of have to figure it out each time?
I mean, I think we're still, I mean, like I said, a lot of things at LinkedIn are still evolving.
Sure.
So we covered a lot of things where we're still learning. Like I said, even like the holistic optimization, we started touching on reinforcement learning and I was like, you know, we haven't really matured our thinking too far there. So you have to try something to like actually know whether it's warranted to invest in it, like horizontally across all of ProML, because that's going to be like building it in a scalable, horizontally leverageable, like abstracted way. That's a significant investment, right? You have to tailor not just to feed, but like a lot of different verticals, a lot of different use cases. And so if we're pushing the boundary of techniques at LinkedIn or trying something new, you have to try it. And so oftentimes we won't wait for the platform, right? We will test it out, and maybe it's not built in a generalizable way, but we actually have to prove that there is business value to what we are doing before we ask like a horizontal team to actually make this available across the board, because there are many like foundational things that we could be building that we know will apply, you know, across verticals, and maybe the particular technology we're building actually is only useful for feed. Or maybe it's only useful for feed for now, like for the next like, you know, year or two. Maybe like other teams just don't need it at this stage in their life cycle because they're evolving down a different path. And so we do actually, within the Feed AI team, we have a foundations team that is separate from ProML. Okay. And that team is completely geared towards kind of empowering this fast iteration of like innovation and figuring out like what's working and what isn't. So we can go back to the ProML team and say like, hey, you know, we were trying to solve this problem. We found this technique that works. We built out like a prototype of the infrastructure that works for feed and this will scale. Like, we think you should consider this as part of your roadmap to like roll out across all verticals. And that's what I meant when it's like a symbiotic relationship. Like, it's not like we can, as an organization, wait for everything to be built perfectly horizontally. You have to push the boundaries in kind of like an agile and quick way. And you're right that sometimes will generate some code debt. You'll have to, you know, pay it down at some point in the future. I'm of the opinion that like, you know, technical debt is not terrible. I think some people avoid technical debt at all costs. Technical debt is there so you can take on some debt to move faster. Obviously, you do not want your debt to like spiral out of control. But if you're able to manage that in a sane way, then like you're actually going to be pushing forward both the boundaries of your vertical, but also how fast ProML moves and discovers new opportunities that they should be making available horizontally.
Are there things that come to mind as a customer of a platform, you know, independent of the specifics of the relationship between the ProML team and your team, that you know, just as a customer, I want a platform team to be, you know, doing thing XYZ or thinking thing, you know, in way XYZ, like what's your wish list for kind of that relationship, I guess?
One of the unique things I think about how the AI org is organized at LinkedIn is that it's completely centralized, right? Like, you know, Deepak Agarwal has like all the engineers working with AI report to him. There's like, you know, 400 whatever engineers. All the requests are very centralized and all the teams work together like in a really collaborative way. It never feels like we are a client asking like some remote team or like, you know, horizontal like platform provider to support us. Definitely not in the way like you might, if you're bootstrapping a startup today, you'd go to AWS, right? And might use their machine learning platform. You don't have like a direct path to ask them for like what you need. This is all within the same team, within the same company at LinkedIn, where we all kind of have a joint understanding of what our requests are. So as a consumer of ProML, like I think that there is, like I said, there's that loop of innovation where like verticals kind of push the boundaries in areas where like maybe there's a unique problem in their domain that feeds back into the ProML platform. I don't think there's ever kind of a tension in terms of how, what we're asking for from the platform, which I mean, it's kind of rare. And I think we're fortunate to be in that situation.
Mm-hmm. So kind of thing one on that list is just make sure to keep that collaborative loop tight and don't kind of minimize the barriers between kind of platform consumers and platform providers.
And I think, I mean, you can take examples, I mean, just from my past, like, so AI at LinkedIn was not always like this centralized. So, you know, when Pulse was acquired, the Pulse relevance team was actually a separate team in a separate org, not in the relevance org. And the advantage there is that those AI engineers were embedded with like their product domain. And so like they completely understood the strategy. They were really close with all their other engineering partners, had really close relationships there. The downside is that you can't tap into this like giant wealth of knowledge and momentum from like a centralized AI org in terms of all the kind of research that's going on foundationally, new techniques. Like you're only a team of maybe like three or four embedded engineers in a product vertical when you have the distributed model. And that makes it much more difficult to tap into like that knowledge base that we have in today's model. So it is like really important how you set up your organization to make sure you're maximizing the value and the feedback that's going to the horizontal platform.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, is the AI org exclusively centralized, or do you have kind of a, you know, I'll talk to folks that embrace more of like a hub and spoke model where you know, there's a centralized org that is, you know, defining, you know, best practices, if you will, building tooling and platform, you know, but also like embedding data scientists, machine learning engineers within product teams, you know, for periods of time to help them deliver features. Like, how does that manifest itself at LinkedIn?
It's definitely not exclusively centralized. Like, I work very closely with our feed product team, work very closely with like our feed consumer engineering partners that are building like the mobile clients. I mean, you have to be. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like a virtual team that works on that particular product area. And that's usually how, I guess, hub and spoke model might be kind of the right analogy here. Mm-hmm. But it's really, it depends on like a vertical's needs. And so it differs but from vertical to vertical. At the end of the day, though, like, let's say you don't even have a well-fleshed out like product team or product mm-hmm. counterpart. What this kind of centralization within the AI org offers is you can actually bootstrap something using the wealth of knowledge and techniques that are like already at your fingertips from like ProML and all these other verticals without starting from scratch, embedding with like a brand new product like you would at maybe a startup. And so it's not exclusively centralized in the sense that like we obviously collaborate with our partners, but there is a great degree of centralization that enables collaboration across the org.
As we're kind of following this thread around, you know, organizational themes and kind of platform providers, consumers, like any other thoughts for folks that are maybe earlier on in this path than LinkedIn, things that have helped you be successful?
There's so much kind of fragmentation in the like cloud machine learning offerings in the industry now. So like, I'm not really going to go into that in terms of how you might build like a machine learning shop from scratch. But I do think that actually like the important lesson going back to what we were talking about earlier is really understanding how you formulate your problem early on. And I think this is actually something now looking back at Pulse that like we may have been really short-sighted by like focusing on like, you know, this day's revenue or like this day's engagement and not focusing on the like more holistic picture of like, what is your ecosystem? Mm-hmm. Define your problem space and then understand both the short-term and long-term effects and how they trade off with each other. And I think, you know, coming from a startup, oftentimes you're very focused on that like short-term milestone. And you actually might be sacrificing a lot of long-term growth and engagement mm-hmm. by not taking time and saying, like, let's actually think about how we're using machine learning to solve this problem. It's very easy to be a machine learning expert these days and kind of like find a tutorial to do like solve the exact problem that you're trying to solve for your startup. And I think the real like value of machine learning is when you actually give it a harder problem than those that you see, like the simple problem that you've thought of, like we need to solve this particular like ranking problem mm-hmm. for like a feed. Thinking more about all the actors in your ecosystem, all the different content types, all the different intents, and pushing the boundary of like what machine learning can help you do. I think that's probably the most useful insight going from a small startup to a big company where we actually have had much more time to think through those different components.
You know, in some ways it's like jumping to the end game. Can you do that without like going through the steps? Like is there an approach to getting you there or a way of thinking about it that allows you to know which of the steps you need to skip versus what you have to pass through?
Yeah. Your point is like spot on, which is like, it's easy to identify like this as something you should do when you've already like evolved to this point in terms of your technical capability. But actually, I think it's always useful to evaluate kind of like how far AI has come and how easy it is now to like do a lot of really fundamental and basic like things, solve a lot of like the simpler problems in AI. When I was saying like, you know, automating all these kind of basic capabilities within our team, a lot of that is offered on like a lot of different like cloud platforms, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so folks that want to use machine learning are actually kind of freed up now from some of those lower level logistics. And you can kind of skip a few steps ahead. You know, if you go to the very beginning of LinkedIn, we were still like trying to get like logistic regression working for like a CTR based model. We had to start with like recency based model. You don't actually have to do that anymore, right? Out the gate, you can actually start with kind of what is pretty state of the art in the industry. And I think that's why it's so important to spend that extra time thinking through your ecosystem. Like, what is it you're building? What are the levers you have at your disposal in your product to actually to shape the product experience you're trying to build? And so I do think that like the advancements in ML and AI kind of over the last decade, like it's gotten easy enough to do that you're actually maybe not burdened by some of the stuff that, you know, LinkedIn had to deal with or Pulse had to deal with in the really early days when like the tooling was not nearly the way it is today. The kinds of technologies that were available out of the box in terms of how you use neural nets, I mean, even TensorFlow, like that's something that I think in the last really 5 to 7 years has really blown up as like, you know, standard tooling. And that is all now available to anybody bootstrapping a product out of the box. So you can skip that. You can skip that. And LinkedIn did spend a lot of time in that area. And you can start moving into like these problem definition type scenarios.
So invest the time and energy saved in building out kind of core infrastructure and being more thoughtful about the way you approach the value you're trying to deliver to whoever the customer is.
I think you summarized it much more articulately than I did, but yeah, that's spot on.
It's a great point. It's a great point. Well, Tim, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me. It's a great, great conversation and I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on Tim or any of the topics covered in this episode, visit twimmelai.com/talk/224. Thanks again to LinkedIn for their support of this show. Be sure to check out what their engineering team is up to at engineering.linkedin.com/blog. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.